A reluctant witness is in flux. Will former special counsel Robert Mueller testify? And when?
Part and parcel of the negotiations with Bob Mueller and his team is that he wants to limit the amount of time there'll be public testimony.
An old plea deal comes back to haunt Alexander Acosta, now out as Labor Secretary.
Mr. Acosta said that he did not want to be a distraction for the good economic story that the administration can put forward. And essentially, he was.
President Trump gives up on his quest for a citizenship question on the 2020 census, but he's still pressing for a complete headcount of who's in the United States.
This whole process does not happen in a matter of weeks. It happens over the course of months and months. And in the meantime, the census forms need to be printed.
And a former member of Antifa takes off his mask.
It's not something that I've been, say, proud about. It's I would talk to about it with some of my close friends, and it was just recently when a lot of people started encouraging me to go ahead and tell my story.
For Jared Halpert, I'm Rachel Sutherland from Washington. Special Counsel Robert Mueller, as enigmatic as ever. His scheduled appearance is Wednesday on Capitol Hill, now up in the air, at least at the time we recorded this program. Democrats spent days furiously preparing their questions so they could get as much out of him as possible. Some are poring over old video of previous testimony and rereading his 448-page report. They want to know more about his conclusions on Russian interference in the 2016 election and about his decision not to come to a conclusion on whether President Trump committed obstruction of justice. During a public statement in May, Mueller made it clear he wouldn't be dropping any bombshells should he be compelled to testify.
The report is my testimony. I would not provide information beyond that which is already public in any appearance before Congress.
Republicans also have questions, but it's not clear how many will get a shot at Mueller if he testifies. Republicans on the House Judiciary Committee are worried they'll be excluded due to time constraints. GOP Congressman Louie Gohmert of Texas.
Both sides of the aisle ought to all be able to ask questions and not be marginalized by the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, but we got rolled.
Republicans would likely ask about President Trump's claim that his campaign was spied on, about the Steele dossier and anti-Trump text messages sent between FBI employees. But it's also unlikely the taciturn Mueller would give them the answers they seek. Committee Democrats said they need to limit the first public session to 2 hours, meaning many members on the House Judiciary Committee will not get to ask questions. Republicans claim limiting lawmaker questions violates longstanding House rules. Chad Pergram is senior Capitol Hill producer for Fox News. Hey, Chad.
Hi there.
So as we stand right now, the Mueller hearing is in flux. What in the world is going on? What have you been hearing?
That's the exact phrase that we've heard for days now. I mean, they held a meeting about this Wednesday night. And all of the Democratic members kept walking out. They were supposedly trying to find out the structure and how it was going to be handled. And they kept saying, it's in flux. It's in flux. And it really went into flux on Friday when there were members of Congress, members of the leadership, Capitol Hill security and protocol officials who were told that this was being postponed for a week to the 24th instead of the 17th. I spoke with Jim Jordan, Republican congressman from Ohio, a senior member of that committee, and he said, I've heard all sorts of things. He said, we've been trying to find out what the structure is of this hearing for weeks now, and we still don't understand the format. Part of it is that we heard that the Intelligence Committee might have been trying to back off. They do have an actual operational problem. Here's why. In the House rules, House Rule 11, Clause 2J, says that you have to allot 5 minutes for every member of Congress on a committee to ask questions. If you look at the Judiciary Committee alone, now keep in mind that we're going to have 2 hours for Judiciary and 2 hours for Intelligence. The Judiciary Committee has 41 people. I'm not real good at math, but that's well over 3 hours.
Yeah.
And that's not including opening statements by the chairman, the ranking minority member, the witness, maybe disruptions from the crowd, bookkeeping, parliamentary tactics. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, remember the Kavanaugh hearings and what happened there with all those.
Yeah, that took an hour and 16 minutes before they even got to Chuck Grassley read 12 words of his opening statement. 12. And they started to have parliamentary motions and dilatory tactics and protests. And that it took an hour and 16, hour and 17 minutes before they even got to into the meat of the hearing.
One thing that was hanging about on a cliff for a while was the 9/11 victim compensation fund. The House, they took action on that.
Yes, an overwhelming vote, which was expected, 402 to 12. The 12 defectors were Republicans, 11 Republicans, and Justin Amash, the independent congressman now from Michigan. I spoke with John Stewart, who has been, you know, one of the main advocates for these first responders, along with John Thiel, who's been this first responder advocate who's been walking around Capitol Hill. John Stewart said that, and this is the quote here, Rachel, "It's hard for me to understand why we're still here and why anyone would vote against it and not have unanimous consent." And John Thiel said now they're going to have some guerrilla tactics in the Senate. They said they, quote, forced this vote. They said it probably would have been weeks away had they not made a lot of noise up here a few weeks ago. They forced a meeting with Mitch McConnell. And John Thiel says that they're going to do more grassroots activism. They're going to use his term, guerrilla lobbying. And here's the real quote here from John Thiel, who works with John Stewart on this. This is as he walked out of the Capitol on Friday afternoon. Quote, "For those who don't get on there, they suck. And they shouldn't be in office."
Wow.
Close quote.
Wow, that's pretty intense. So, but the question now remains, because I know John Stewart had a real problem with Mitch McConnell, the leader of the Senate. And is there any word as to when the Senate would take up this bill?
Well, McConnell has indicated they're going to do this before the start of the August recess. The Senate is scheduled to be here a little bit longer than the House. Sometimes the starts and stops of these August recess are very much up in the air. And the reason that this is even a little more up in the air is because we have this issue that's materialized, really come to life in the past week or so, about raising the debt ceiling. Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, had been on Capitol Hill multiple times. He's had multiple conversations with McConnell, phone calls with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And the concern is that they could hit the debt limit. In other words, the total amount of red that the federal government is allowed to cover, carry on the books legally, in early September, possibly before lawmakers return. And so what we're hearing right now, and this is far from settled, is what they might do is a temporary extension or increase or canceling of the debt ceiling for a few months, a month, maybe till the end of the year. And that way you don't have a market shock or something along those lines.
I want to pivot real quickly here to some of this infighting that's been going on in the Democratic Party. It almost seems like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is dealing with a group of almost mean girls, if you will, with her tweets and that kind of thing. But
well, they call themselves the squad.
I know they call themselves the squad.
These four liberal members, freshman Democratic members, yes.
Yes. But so Pelosi has a real challenge in getting them kind of on her side. And usually she's a pretty much master politician and is able to do that. And it seemed like when she was speaking this week to reporters, she was trying to, you know, tamp down the perceived factions between herself and the squad.
There's that. But she's also been clear that, you know, if you have a problem with something I've said or done, if you have a problem, come to me, talk about it. Just don't start sending tweets. And then you had Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the freshman Democrat from New York, who really pushed this over the line, suggesting that these members, herself, Rashida Tlaib from Michigan, Ayanna Pressley from Massachusetts, and Ilhan Omar from Minnesota, were all being targeted by the speaker because they are persons of color. William Lacey Clay is a senior Democrat from Missouri, senior member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and for him, he said that was a bridge too far. He said it was, quote, a weak argument. He said this has no place in civil discussions. He said for these freshmen to make these comments, they really must not understand what the Democratic caucus is about when it comes to the legacy of fighting racism and working on those issues. And he said they don't even understand racism if they're accusing the Speaker of the House on that issue. Here's the other issue, though, for Nancy Pelosi. If you look back at her track record, she has notably sidelined other up-and-coming Democratic women. Now, some of that is because she's been able to do it, and she's the most accomplished female in American politics. No other female has risen to that stature as Nancy Pelosi. But there have been other women who have come along in the Democratic caucus over the years who she has sidelined, notably Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who had trouble with Pelosi, the congresswoman from Florida, long before she had issues when she was the DNC chair. You have Marcy Kaptur, who is the most senior Democrat in the House, first elected in 1982, who is a member of the Appropriations Committee and is not the Appropriations Committee chair. Granted, there is another appropriator who is the chair of that committee, Nita Lowey, who obviously is female, but she is, you know, not as senior as Marcy Kaptur. Jane Harman, a Democrat, former congresswoman from California, had aspirations to be in the leadership, maybe be leader, maybe be speaker, and she was undercut by Nancy Pelosi. So some people point out that you know, this is some of Nancy Pelosi's calling card, that sometimes she has not been helpful to up-and-coming women But then again, you know, you can look up and down. She does have other women who are allies and at her leadership table. But there are three pretty good examples there. And one wonders if maybe what's going on with these Democratic freshman women, if that's part and parcel of the issue she's had with Harmon and Kaptur and also with Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
So next week we're looking for a possible appearance by Robert Mueller and this possible fight over the debt ceiling.
Yes, absolutely. That's what's coming down the pike.
Okay, Chad. Thanks. Have a good one.
Thank you.
Back to Washington's mystery man, Robert Mueller. If and when he testifies, it's sure to be a spectacle. But lawmakers may not get much red meat from the former special counsel. As lawmakers argued about the terms of his appearance, the House Judiciary Committee authorized subpoenas for a dozen big names connected to the Russia probe, including White House advisor Jared Kushner, former Attorney General Jeff Sessions, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, and former White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, Chairman Jerry Nadler.
We will not rest until we obtain their testimony and documents.
Ranking Republican Doug Collins accused the committee of going on a subpoena binge.
This is again another trek down an empty road.
Republicans say the committee should have waited to issue the subpoenas until after Robert Mueller's testimony. It's not clear whether the witnesses will comply with the subpoenas, as the White House has asserted executive privilege over much of the Mueller investigation. Catherine Herridge is chief intelligence correspondent for Fox News.
Well, one of the rules of thumb on the Hill is that you never let a witness dictate the terms of their appearance. They come for as long as is necessary. But it appears that part and parcel of the negotiations with Bob Mueller and his team is that he wants to limit the amount of time there'll be public testimony. So 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours in the afternoon. And that seems like a long period of time. But when you start to run the math, what you see is between the House and the intelligence committees, there are over 60 members, and they each get 5 minutes. And this really comes into play with the House Judiciary Committee. There are about 41 members. That's way over the 2 hours. That means a lot of the junior members will not be allowed to ask their questions.
Is that both Democrats and Republicans then? So it's not like Republicans are being singled out as They're the ones complaining, though.
Republicans and Democrats who are not going to get a chance to ask their questions of the principal witness in the Russia investigation, if you will, are not happy with what's being negotiated. And my sense is that we're less than a week out. They haven't finalized the details about the public hearing, nor have they finalized details over whether there'll be a closed-door hearing with some of Robert Mueller's closest aides from the Russia investigation. And the New York Times has reported that the Justice Department has told those Mueller aides not to testify behind closed doors because effectively it would go outside, as Mueller says, the four corners of his report.
Right. Now, we obviously know what Democrats want to ask should they get a chance to speak to Robert Mueller. They want to ask about his decision not to go with obstruction of justice towards the president. Republicans, they would ask different questions. I mean, do you think that they would ask about, because we know that Mueller's not going to answer it, things about President Trump's claim that his campaign was spied on, the Steele dossier, all of that?
Well, just to sort of recap or reset for folks at home, Democrats really want to understand why was it that Robert Mueller did not recommend criminal charges against the president on obstruction. And there seems to be some daylight between what we've heard from the attorney general and what we've heard from Robert Mueller. Robert Mueller seemed to suggest in his only public statement that there was a Justice Department legal opinion that prevented him from bringing any charges against a sitting president. But the attorney general recently testified that he and Mueller had a conversation before the report was complete. And he says Mueller told him it was nothing to do with this legal opinion. It really had more to do with the evidence in the case. And to answer your question about the Republicans, they want to know, why didn't you look at the genesis of the Russia investigation?
Right.
Why didn't you take a harder look at the Steele dossier that was opposition research funded by Democrats that was used to secure a surveillance warrant for one of the Trump campaign aides? And how early did you know, Robert Mueller, that there was no criminal conspiracy between the Trump campaign and Russia? And based on the timeline in our reporting, it looks like he reached that conclusion maybe not with absolute certainty, but with a high degree of confidence by the fall of 2017, so just a few months into the investigation, because at that time they did not renew the surveillance warrant for Trump campaign aide Carter Page, and they had already interviewed the author of the dossier, Christopher Steele. And that says to me, from my experience, that they had ruled out any validity to the dossier at that point in time, or it was not going to be an anchor of their investigation.
That's really fascinating. So then I guess presumably the American public can be a bit perturbed that it went on so long. And the last part of it was obstruction, I guess.
Well, like any investigation, and I want to say that the Steele interview with the special counsel was first reported by, I believe it was Reuters, and it said September of 2017. So that's pretty early in the investigation. Like all investigations, you never have absolute certainty until the very end because things can have a habit of coming up. But there is a point at which you say, I have high confidence that this is not going to play out. I'm now going to take my resources and refocus them on another area. And Republicans want to know if Robert Mueller knew that there was not going to be evidence of a criminal conspiracy with the Russians. And so he then focused on obstruction of justice. And their position is that Director Comey, FBI Director James Comey, the president was within his authority to fire him as the FBI director, and that he was fired because the president was unhappy with his performance as director, not because he thought he would end the Russia probe with the termination.
How much of a zoo are you expecting these hearings to be?
I think there's a lot of risk or potential jeopardy for both Republicans and Democrats in this hearing, because if Robert Mueller does appear on the 17th and he does stick to the four corners of the report, and what we have is a public testimony where he's continually referring back to the testimony in the report, or he has a number of sort of what I would call sort of canned lines for questions he's not going to answer, it's going to be a sort of dramatic disappointment.
Right, a flop.
Yeah. And if you think back to, we've had the former White House counsel John Dean from Watergate testify.
I remember.
That was, I don't want to characterize it, but it was not.
Well, he wasn't a fact witness. That's what everyone was talking about.
Exactly. He was not someone with firsthand knowledge of the investigation. And then there was a follow-up hearing with three individuals who are legal experts, but again, they were not fact witnesses, and Republicans accused Democrats of bringing in pundits from different cable news channels, and they said that was not really the role for Congress. So I think there's a lot of risk or jeopardy for both sides. For Republicans, Robert Mueller could say, I did not recommend charges for the president because I felt my hands were tied because of this Justice Department legal opinion.
That'll be interesting. Now, one more question. What about these subpoenas that are going out to a dozen folks, big names, too? Jeff Sessions, a former attorney general, Rod Rosenstein, who is overseeing the Russia probe. And there's complaints from Republicans that they should have waited for these subpoenas until after they questioned Robert Mueller.
Right. So the subpoenas are broad. They largely go to allegations of obstruction of justice by the president. And then they also go to these so-called hush money payments prior to the elections. I would emphasize it has nothing to do with a conspiracy between Russia and the Trump campaign to affect the election in 2016.
Thanks, Catherine.
You're welcome.
It wasn't the most unexpected news in Washington this week when Alexander Acosta announced he's leaving his job as labor secretary. Democrats called on Acosta to resign after it was revealed he brokered a plea deal for financier Jeffrey Epstein more than 10 years ago in Florida involving an underage sex trafficking ring. Senator Richard Blumenthal among Democrats who called on him to step down.
He betrayed his position as a prosecutor. It was secret, immoral, and likely illegal.
With no Republicans in Congress defending him, Acosta said he called President Trump and offered his resignation, saying it would be selfish to remain in charge at the Labor Department.
I do not think it is right and fair for this administration's Labor Department to have Epstein as the focus rather than the incredible economy that we have today.
President Trump, on his way to Wisconsin, said Acosta could have stayed in his position, calling his departure very sad.
I hate to see it happen. I will say this, and I say it again and I say it loud and clear. Alex Acosta was a great Secretary of Labor.
Earlier this week, Acosta defended himself in a news conference, saying he bucked state prosecutors at the time.
The Palm Beach State Attorney's Office was ready to let Epstein walk free. No jail time. Nothing.
Acosta said after he intervened, Epstein pleaded guilty to a lesser charge, spent about a year in prison, and had to register as a sex offender. The state prosecutor at the time issued a statement saying, I can emphatically state that Mr. Acosta's recollection of the matter is completely wrong. The secret deal came to light after Epstein was booked on new charges in New York. Patrick Pezzella will take over as acting labor secretary. Meanwhile, the fight over the 2020 census came to a screeching halt this week when President Trump abandoned his effort to add a citizenship question. But he says he's not giving up his effort to get a complete head count of everyone in the country, including those here illegally.
We will defend the right of the American people to know the full facts about the population, size of citizens and non-citizens in America. We will leave no stone unturned.
Speaking in the Rose Garden, the president said he signed an executive order requiring federal agencies to give information about citizens and non-citizens to the Commerce Department.
To have an even more complete count of citizens than through asking the single question alone.
The move came after the president floated the idea of adding the citizenship question by executive order. But the administration was running out of time, as the forms had already gone to the printer. Late last month, the U.S. Supreme Court dealt a blow to the White House when justices sent the battle back to the lower courts so new evidence could be reviewed that might shed light on the administration's motive for adding the question. John Decker covers the White House for Fox News Radio. Thanks for joining me, John.
Hey, thanks a lot, Rachel. Appreciate it.
So I guess this wasn't really big news with the resignation, the announcement of Alexander Acosta, who's going to be leaving the Labor Department after this scandal involving financier Jeffrey Epstein. Give us a little background on what happened.
Well, this all happened 10 years ago when Alex Acosta served as the U.S. attorney for the Southern District of Florida. And during his tenure, he signed off on a plea deal that allowed Jeffrey Epstein to serve only 13 months in prison, Rachel, for crimes that he could have faced a life sentence for, all having to do with his guilty plea to being essentially a pedophile. He had a report and still is considered a sexual offender and has to identify him as such in every jurisdiction in the United States in which he's present. So this came back because of the most recent announcement from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York that Mr. Epstein has been indicted again for sex trafficking, and renewed attention came upon that plea deal that happened 10 years ago that Mr. Acosta was responsible for signing off on ultimately.
Now, often we see the president vehemently defending people in his administration who are criticized. In this case, do you think the president kind of got a little daylight between himself and Acosta?
I do. You know, I was in the Oval Office on Monday and had an opportunity to ask the president the question, do you still have confidence in Labor Secretary Acosta, not only now, but also in the future? And the president answered in such a way that said he's very proud of the job that he's done as Labor Secretary. But at the same time, he also said that he's studying the situation very carefully. And I've heard that language before coming from the president, Rachel. I've heard it when he studied whether or not to get rid of his HHS secretary, Dr. Price. And ultimately, Dr. Price was let go. Now, in this particular case, it's Mr. Acosta who says that he came to the president to submit his resignation. But the result is the same. Controversy enveloped these individuals who worked in President Trump's cabinet. And ultimately, the controversy was too much to bear. And those individuals, at least in Mr. Acosta's case, his resignation takes effect next Friday.
Now, the president was standing next to Acosta when he made this announcement as the president was getting ready to leave for Wisconsin. That looked like the president was putting a positive note on Acosta's departure, although he said he was sad to see him go.
That's right. But ultimately, he accepted the resignation that Mr. Acosta submitted to the president. I think that this term often gets used in Washington, but in this case, it's very much true. And that is, Mr. Acosta said that he did not want to be a distraction for the good economic story that the administration can put forward. And essentially, he was a distraction, Rachel. So much attention was being focused upon Mr. Acosta. He had an hour-long press conference earlier this week. The story was not going away, especially when you consider that individuals that he put the blame on for the sentence, the state attorney's office in Florida, they were pushing back, and they were saying that Mr. Acosta was not telling the full story about the narrative that led to that 13-month prison sentence.
Yeah, that's one thing for sure. The Epstein case is not going away at all, and it would have continued to be a distraction. We're understanding that Patrick Pezzella will take over as acting labor secretary. Let's turn now to the 2020 census fight and the battle over the citizenship question. The president took an about-face on this issue and spoke about it in the Rose Garden. Tell me what he had to say.
Well, this was a realization by the administration that they did not have the time in which to pursue legal efforts to get the citizenship question on the 2020 census. The Supreme Court ruled against the administration about 2 weeks ago or so, saying that that particular question could not be put on the 2020 census for now. They needed to come up with a better rationale, but that would be at the district court level. And that, of course, regardless of the decision that a district court judge ultimately came up with, that would be challenged and would be appealed. And this whole process does not happen in a matter of weeks. It happens over the course of months and months. And in the meantime, the census forms need to be printed. And the administration had already said that they had a drop-dead deadline of June the 30th for knowing whether or not this particular question was going to be on the 2020 census. Of course, that deadline has now come and gone, and the president acknowledging as much in a press conference that he had in the Rose Garden and saying that he's dropping all efforts to put that particular question on the 2020 census.
Still, he said he signed an executive order requiring federal agencies to give the Commerce Department an accounting of all citizens and non-citizens. Isn't this something they could have done before? It's readily available information?
Yes, he could have. The president could have done option C, as the administration called it, on day one of the Trump presidency. You're the president. You can tell your agency heads, you can tell your department heads to provide that information, and it's they will answer to the president. So they will indeed now provide that information to the president. But in terms of determining how many people are in the country, that is ultimately what the census does. And that action by the president that was announced yesterday will not change those numbers in any way.
What's on tap for the president coming up this week?
The president is out of town on Friday. The reason being is because he's going out to the Midwest. The president and his political team recognize how important the Midwest is in terms of winning re-election in 2020. After all, in 2016, as you know, Rachel, the president did what Republicans have been unable to do for many election cycles, and that is the president won Michigan and Ohio and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And on Friday, the president traveled to two of those battleground states, Wisconsin and also Ohio. And both of those states will figure prominently in the president's reelection run in 2020.
No doubt about it. And we'll be talking with you about it, John. Thanks.
Thanks a lot, Rachel. Have a great weekend.
They're known for black clothing, masks, and sometimes violence. Anti-fascist protesters, also known as Antifa, they've been around in some form or another for decades, but they've been catching mainstream attention recently after brutal attacks. They were in Charlottesville, Virginia during race-fueled riots, although it was a white supremacist who killed a young woman with his car. In Berkeley, California, Antifa members reportedly caused $100,000 in damage as they protested the appearance of an ultra-right speaker. An attack on a conservative journalist last month in Portland once again put Antifa in the spotlight. Andy No, an editor for Quillette, was on the scene during a clash between the far-right Proud Boys and Antifa when he was beat up and doused with milkshakes in an apparent unprovoked attack that was captured on camera. No described what happened to Fox News.
Punches just kept coming in every direction, and then eventually they escalated it to throwing liquids in my face that blinded me, so I couldn't even see which way to leave. And I could still see the Justice Center in the background, and I kept thinking the police were going to come and help me at any moment. but that never happened.
No said he had to seek medical treatment for his wounds. Antifa members say they believe in aggressively opposing far right-wing movements, racists and fascists. They condone violence, harassment, and property damage. Antifa is not organized. It's made up of several autonomous groups and individuals. Members say physical confrontations are a necessary part of their work, but it's not the only or most important part of what they do. Members argue that the Nazis in Germany could have been stopped if people had fought back on the streets. Antifa also participates in doxing, researching and releasing private information about people they target. The group has been catching the attention of law enforcement and members of Congress. Republican Senator Ted Cruz says Antifa are domestic terrorists, and he wants a federal investigation into what happened in Portland. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy called the attack cowardly, tweeting the hate and violence perpetrated by Antifa must be condemned in the strongest way possible by all Americans. What motivates someone to join the Antifa movement? And who leaves? Fox News found a former Antifa member, Gabriel Nadalis. He says enough is enough, and Antifa needs to be stopped.
So the Antifa movement really started out in the 1920s, but the modern Antifa started kind of in the 80s with a lot of different different factions throughout the country and as well as in different countries. There's a lot of similarities, but they're completely two different groups. The idea just started in the 1920s. My involvement was from just attending a protest from time to time to actually gearing up and recruiting people to go into the protests together. We went to a lot of the Occupy protests at the time. They were very big.
Oh, yeah.
Down in Los Angeles. We'd go downtown from time to time. And I also went into anti-neo-Nazi rallies and just a lot of different things, both individually and in a group.
What do you think their motivations are? I mean, are some of them going in with good intentions? They really are concerned about some of the political directions that take place that they're deeply concerned about? Or are they looking for a place to belong? I mean, who gets recruited into Antifa and why?
I went in with the good intentions. That's also why I left.
We'll get to that.
Yeah. From some conversations I had with them, they were very concerned about capitalism, and they saw capitalism as one of the worst evils in human history. Unfortunately, when you talk to them, if you agree with them, then you can have conversations about different things, such as oh, well, maybe will socialism work? Will mutual aid work? Or communism, whatever. But if you disagree with them or maybe defend any aspect of capitalism, they can get very, they'll basically tell you to F off. It's not nice.
Okay. And we saw that attack on the reporter. What are some of the most shocking things you've seen?
I think the worst thing that I saw was at a rally towards the end. There was a guy I knew who he was in the middle of getting arrested. And then there was two other people. One of them I did know. They went up and one of them pushed the cop back. The second punched them. And then they went back into the black block. So I guess that's probably the worst thing I saw.
Mm. And people get arrested over that?
Yeah, but this guy didn't.
How long were you a member of Antifa?
For about 2 years. It was from around 2010 to 2012. I was still in high school throughout all this.
Oh, okay. What'd your parents think?
Kind of funny. I told them, once I became a conservative, I told them about that I used to go to protests. But they barely found out that I was part of Antifa.
Oh, okay. You kept it on the sly.
Yeah. It's not something that I've been, proud about. I would talk about it with some of my close friends. And it was just recently when a lot of people started encouraging me to go ahead and tell my story.
Yeah. And tell me why you decided to leave.
Well, the reason I left was because I'm somebody who likes to question my own beliefs. There was multiple times where I tried to do that, and I tried questioning people in Antifa, but they just, they would not entertain me. So for a while, I was in this limbo of what do I really believe? Because I had a lot of questions. I was still on the left, but somebody from the Leadership Institute, they took me under their wing. And he recommended a lot of different books. Anytime I would talk to him about different issues, he would actually talk to me instead of just insulting me and telling me to get out of here. And it was just a slow transition into being a conservative.
Have you heard from any members since, especially since you've been speaking out?
No, thank goodness not. The good thing about this is that even though I did know a few, a lot of other people knew who I was, but they don't know my real name.
Oh, got it. Well, we'll keep it on the down low. Gabriel. But what is the future, do you think, of Antifa moving forward, especially with the divisions in the country? We saw over the 4th of July holiday here in the nation's capital a lot of angst and anger on the streets of D.C. at a time when normally we're coming together. And the president, take it or leave it, he's pretty divisive. So do you think Antifa will grow? And what do you think their tactics will be going forward?
I think that the attack against Andy is just the beginning. I mean, 2020 is coming up, and they're going to be looking for any excuse to attack conservatives. I honestly think that what they're doing is a form of voter intimidation. They're trying to intimidate conservatives into not voting for President Trump, into not showing up to the polls, not volunteering, not being part of rallies to support to show support President Trump. They just can't handle that President Trump has been such a great president. It's just in their mind, he thinks he's the worst person in human history.
Right.
When in fact, President Trump has surprised many, and he's been one of the best presidents of my lifetime.
So do you have a message for young people who might be kind of thinking about joining up with Antifa?
Yeah, it's actually something that about 3 months ago, my niece is in middle school, and I've never really told her anything of the things that I've done, but I told her just to be careful and not to become over emotional over politics, because even though I'm a strong conservative supporter and I'm pretty conservative, but I still question my own beliefs because I could be wrong. So I think anyone in Antifa who's kind of questioning it, just try to come to our side, not necessarily come to our side, but talk to us, engage us. We're good people.
All right, Gabriel, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That'll do it for the From Washington podcast this week. This week, we'll bring you all the latest on Special Counsel Robert Mueller's testimony on Capitol Hill whenever it happens. We'll also keep you up to date on negotiations over the debt ceiling and dueling defense authorization bills. Also, the second round of Democratic presidential debates is coming up at the end of the month in Detroit. There will be 20 candidates again, but some different rules. For one, candidates who interrupt too much will be penalized, although it's not clear what that penalty will be. If you're looking for a politics fix, make sure to listen to The Candidates with Brett Baer, downloaded automatically to your podcast playing device every Tuesday morning. And if you like this podcast from Washington, give us a rating and review. We would really like to hear your feedback. Thanks for listening. For Jared Halpern, I'm Rachel Sutherland from Washington.